Before the resurgence of farmers' markets, the rise of the organic movement, and the renaissance of local agriculture now underway across the country, stepping outside the conventional food system simply was not a realistic option for most people. Now it is. We are entering a post-industrial era of food. For the first time in a generation, it is possible to leave behind the Western diet without having also to leave behind civilization. That's from Michael Pollan's book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What role do farmers' markets play? And is everything you buy at a market organic? What's the difference between organic and natural food? Why might it be important to eat locally? Joining us to discuss farmers' markets and sustainable food systems are two guests from University of Wisconsin. Jack Kloppenberg is professor of community and environmental sociology and the founder and board member of the REAP Food Group. Barry Orton is professor of telecommunications and a board member of Madison's West Side Community Market.
Well, Barry, welcome back to University of the Air. It's been not that long since we talked cable with you, and welcome to University of the Air, Jack.
Thank you very much.
I have to first express my disappointment that you didn't bring free samples with you, but we'll try to carry on anyway, and I see he's got something over there in the corner. And while he's excavating that, what accounts for this? All right,
we have pea pods.
We have three pea pods. Thank you. It's been so long since anyone has been so thoughtful.
Not just pea pods. Those are sugar snap peas. You eat that whole thing.
This is a
remarkable product of plant breeders and genes from Southeast Asia.
Yes, I am familiar with those, as we just got a few of those on the domestic front, and I was told in no uncertain terms, yes, you eat the entire thing,
and pod they were
peas.
Brought for the purpose of doing this. Snapping them in front of the microphone.
They're very expressive. I think you get to eat that one, Barry.
I don't want to crunch in the microphone.
Now, why this resurgence of farmers' markets? I assume they've been out there to some extent all along, but in terms of sort of the urban, maybe even say upscale neighborhood farmers' market, that seems a much more recent development.
Right. Well, as these things come and they go, as you can imagine, most communities across this country had local markets where farmers and other food vendors and vendors of other things used to come on a regular basis and sell in a marketplace. Most of those marketplaces either moved indoors and then got industrialized and then got put out of business ultimately by supermarkets in many cases. We've had a resurgence of farmers markets, and I'm not sure exactly when it started. I guess Jack could probably pinpoint it closer than I could, but it's been a national trend, particularly in large metropolitan areas. The Green Market in New York, for example, has just burgeoned all over the metropolitan area. And here in Madison and Wisconsin, we've had markets in many of the cities for many, many years. And, of course, the granddaddy of them all around here is the Dane County Farmers Market that surrounds the Capitol every Saturday.
It's a wonderful recovery. I remember very clearly growing up in Milwaukee, my mother taking me to the covered farmer's market off Farwell Avenue back in the late 50s, early 60s, and still have a very clear memory of the smells of the flowers and the vegetables. But with the industrialization of the food system, or what Michael Pollan, author of In Defense of Food and the Omnivore's Dilemma, calls the Western diet, the kind of industrialization and the concentration on a very narrow range of foods and industrialized foods. But it's interesting that it isn't just farmers markets. It's a whole interest in food quite generally and in sustainable food in particular that has appeared in the last decade as I think a lot of people confront the environmental crisis and corporate power and hunger and poverty around the world. Food is pleasurable and people are interested in it, but it's also a real interesting direct manifestation of all of these really quite complex global sorts of issues. And it's a very clear way to respond to those. What you put in your mouth three times a day and more connects you very directly to all those difficulties and problematics and is in fact a solution and a portal to a solution. So it's a great good thing as we confront climate change and inequities around the world that people are becoming interested in food again.
Well, the bottom line must be working because the farmers continue to bring the things, and that means people are buying them. So both sides of that buyer-seller equation are obviously happy with what's going on.
There's a lot of benefits to buying local, to buying from people who are producing the food, and to getting to know those people and have a relationship with them. It does break that industrial cycle of buying something from a corporate complex, from a source you really have no way of knowing where it is. And if something goes wrong in that process, like we've had over the last few years with spinach and with apples and with any a number of other industrial food products you can name, you don't know where you can go. If you're buying it from a farmer's market, a genuine farmer's market, you're buying it from the producer. And so you can start to get, and it's just a start, but it's important to get a relationship with that person or persons who are actually producing your food, who own the farm on which it's grown, who own the bakery that bakes the bread that you're eating. That is a guarantee of sorts that if things do break down, if there is some kind of problem in the industrial food chain, you've got an alternative. And that alternative, while it sometimes might be more expensive, sometimes less, it's usually of better quality, it's usually healthier for you, and it's certainly better for the economy of the place you're living in. And that, I think, is probably the bottom line of this, to keep that money local.
You use the phrase genuine farmers market. Are there fake farmers markets? Are
there
ones?
Yeah. There are many. There are things that call themselves farmers markets that are really more generic markets where you can buy and sell goods that you might not necessarily have produced. And there are always wholesale markets in every metropolitan area where restaurants and food suppliers will go and buy large amounts of things that might have been trucked in bulk. Those are not farmers markets. A farmers market, the way I look at it, is a market that is primarily or entirely the producers of that food. And so they can't buy the rules of, for example, the Dane County Market or the West Side Market here in Madison. They cannot buy something from their neighbors or from a passing truck and then pass it off as manufactured or produced by themselves. They must do it themselves. And that, to me, is what a real farmer's market is. It's people who produce the food and then sell it. Does that fit in your definition, Jack?
Well, certainly, ideally, there's the question is what an authentic farmer's market is as complicated as authenticity of anything else. But what you're pointing out is the closest relationship that a buyer or a consumer can have with farmers. And certainly that's ideal, but I think it's a good thing for fresh food to be spread about to as many people as possible. And there certainly is a hierarchy of markets going all the way from the direct contact that one has at what you might call an authentic farmer's market like the Dane County one, where the producer is actually selling the stuff, to a variety of farm stands, which is another way of maybe saying, talking about people who have brought in food from often from local, but from elsewhere, didn't produce it themselves and still selling it, to the production for local retail and co-ops like the Willie Street Co-op and or the Regent Market Co-op here in Madison, or even Century, which is interested actually now in bringing in local food and local sourcing.
How big can they get, though, these farmers markets? I mean, it's very nice to say we should all go downtown and buy directly from farmers and establish a relationship. But if you figure you're in a city of 250,000, you know, how practical is it to say that, 50,000 of them or 100,000 should go down to the farmers market? Wouldn't the system kind of break down?
Get more farmers markets is what happens. here in Madison is a great example. On any given day of the week, there is at least one market somewhere either in Madison or its immediate suburbs. And they rotate kind of day by day because you don't want to compete directly. But on a Saturday, there's probably half a dozen from the downtown market, the big Dane County one, to the West Side one, to one in Hilldale. There's usually one out in Sun Prairie. And then, of course, you drive east and you find there's one in West Allis, which serves the western suburbs of Milwaukee. Then you get downtown and you can get to the Milwaukee Public Market, which is not so much a farmer's market as a more general market. But there are many varieties of farmers markets or markets, and that goes from the farm stand next to the farm to someone who has set up a farm stand in a parking lot of a shopping center and they've taken materials from a lot of different places, including their own farm, and laid it out in a farmer's market-like way. And, of course, you get there and you see, well, they're peaches, and you know the peaches aren't Wisconsin necessarily. They're trucked up from somewhere. Or it might be too early for corn, but there's corn at that farm stand. That's still part of the local food shed, which is a term that Jack kind of invented, which is like the watershed, where the food comes from in a particular area and where it goes. So there are all these varieties of markets and types of markets. But I guess the watchword here is the closer the better, the more local the better, the closer you are to the producer the better, and the fresher, and often the better tasting.
Well, let's take strawberries, for example. Let's say I go to, you know, Walmart or Sam's and get a giant container of strawberries for a lot less money than I would get a little box at the Dane County Farmers Market.
Right.
What is the difference in what I'm buying, what I'm getting, and why I should choose the farmers market strawberries?
Well, the clearest indicator there is taste. That if you go to the farmers market here, you'll find quite a bit smaller strawberries, a different variety. You know, strawberries are genetically diverse. There are different varieties and strains of them. Most of them, as in most of our fresh vegetables, have been bred, because most of them are produced in California, bred to for distance and durability. If they're going to come a long way, they have to be durable. They can't rot in the transport the week that it takes. And they have to be packaged in plastic clamshell, or and the fruit itself has to be firm and hard so that it is still saleable after a week or 10 days. Where's the farmer's market here? And the taste, you know, it's not quite a zero-sum game, but if you breed for distance and durability, you're probably taking out some characteristics of taste. If you're buying from California, you're also buying a product. If you're buying conventional and not organic, you're also buying a strawberry, a fruit that has more pesticide residue on it than any other fruit or vegetable. Strawberries are the most problematic in those terms. And if you go to the Environmental Defense Fund's website, you see a very interesting list in order of the products and the fruits and vegetables and how much pesticide residue they have. In California, even the organic strawberries there produced on conventional farms, which is to say very large, which might have been right next door having a conventional farm, even though it's shifted to organic, and you are employing and they're likely employing Mexican labor at very low wages. So there's not only an environmental question, but a question of equity and the social relationships that you get. Whereas here, even if somebody is spraying pesticides on the strawberries, it's likely a small Hmong or local farmer, and you are still supporting some diversity. But it's scale for me that is much as important as anything else. I like to see a diverse landscape. I like to see diversity almost everywhere. Diversity in the fruits and the vegetables that I have access to, diversity in the markets in which they're available, and diversity in the people who are producing them. And yet here in Wisconsin, even though we can produce virtually everything that we get, although seasonality has something to do with when it's available, 95% of the value coming out of Wisconsin farms are in cattle and dairy. We can be much more diverse. And I think if there's a lesson to be drawn from the environmental crisis that we see around us, is that resilience has to do with diversity. And we need to remember how small still the organic and the local component of our food system is. Organics is somewhere on the order of 4% of the total value that's produced in this country at retail. And local is probably half of that. So it's very, very small yet, and needs to be grown. And back to the question that you had before, is that we do need to grow this, and I think to grow it in a whole range of ways. Farmers market is one avenue, one mode of connection, one vehicle for connecting people with good food. But there are also local producers who don't have access to a farmers market who can sell locally. And the problem actually is that demand right now is way more than either local organic or organic can supply.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is a good, great, good thing.
I mean, for the time being.
If we can find some more producers, what we need to do is either, as Barry was saying, you know, let 1,000 markets bloom, more producers, and we'd like to see more producers, but also we'd like to see some producers perhaps scaling up and producing so that we have an agri-food system that isn't global alone, but that we re-regionalize. And as you were saying, there's a reason why Wisconsin and its capacity can't supply a very substantial proportion of what Milwaukee eats. We're not doing that right now because we're supplying soybeans to the nation and exporting milk to the world. But when you play that commodity game, it's a race to the bottom, and ultimately there are only a few winners, which is why we have an industrialized food system now.
There's another point to this, too, and that is how far the food travels. That same strawberry traveling from California, you're largely buying the cost of getting it there, which is largely buying fossil fuels, which is not, of course, good for the globe as well. So there's all those elements besides, but I think Jack's right. The first one is taste. But again, if you're in Wisconsin and it's December and you're demanding that you have a strawberry thing on top of your dessert and it looks like a strawberry and it's shaped like a strawberry and it sort of tastes like a strawberry, you have a couple of choices. One is to thaw something you've frozen from the season, or to go to that supermarket and buy that California industrial product that looks very much like a strawberry and sort of tastes like one. And probably not too far distant future is going to be injected with some kind of strawberry-like chemical to make it taste more like the one you would have bought in the farmer's market.
You've used the word organic quite a bit. Let's get a definition of what that means, what the rules are if you're going to put the word organic on a product.
Can we do that in a short period of time or a long period of time? If you were a farmer, it would take you hours to get that down. But in a short period of time, things that are organic are what's called certified organic. And there's a national movement that does that. It's partially government controlled and run, but not entirely. But it is the kind of seal of approval that a farmer at a farmer's market or a farmer or a company selling to a supermarket can put on their product. But you're either organic, meaning certified, real organic, or you're not. Is that a reasonably naive way to explain it?
No, that works pretty well. The origins of organic agriculture in the Rodale Institute and home gardeners who were interested not just in not using chemicals but also in the quality of the soil and using production practices that utilized natural cycles. And there was a spiritual element to it as well. And as the organic slowly grew, there were some people that were faking what organic, and there were no requirements that organic had to mean anything. And so some organic farmers were concerned that there ought to be some kind of assurance of that no pesticides are being used. And 5 years ago or so, it took 20 years to get this thing in place, but the U.S. government stepped in, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and said, we're going to make organic means something legislatively, and you're going to have to stick to this, and you will not be able to use the term organic unless you follow our rules. Now, that was controversial because what that did was open up the possibility of organic to much larger producers. The rules themselves are also problematic because you can't use genetically modified organisms, product of transgenes, genetic engineering. You can't use sewage sludge. You can't use synthetic pesticides. You can't use synthetic fertilizers. And there are a couple of other rules, but it's a technical definition. It has nothing to do with animal welfare, almost nothing in any animal welfare rules in there, nor does it have anything to do with wages or the social conditions of production. So it becomes a purely technical definition on what kind of inputs you use. Very little about how you should treat the soil, very little about the kind of cultural practices that you use. It's basically a very narrow definition which has allowed the development of what some people call industrial organic, i.e. farms in California that simply dispense with certain practices which weren't all that useful for them. They were way over the top anyway, and there's where much of our organic production is coming from now. And I think it's important to understand that sustainable does not necessarily mean organic. Organic is not necessarily sustainable. Organic is a very narrow definition. Organic rules say nothing about energy use. So that in winter, I can go into all sorts of places and I can get the organic blueberries that are flown in from New Zealand and are organic because they don't use synthetic pesticides or fertilizers. But they're flown, 10,000 miles on a 747 and packaged in plastic clamshell. That's not sustainable, I think. So we consumers especially need to be careful, especially now that we've got natural and organic. And organic is sort of the gold standard because the USDA has declared it as such. And consumers tend to think of organic, it's good. But in fact, it's a quite narrow definition, and I'm interested in the nuances here and allowing people to buy their food from a whole range of different places that have different characteristics, many of whether it's local, whether it's low input, whether it's transitional to organic, whether you're buying from people who you know might be using pesticides, but they're local. The purity and the fundamentalism that sometimes emerges in this kind of movement, which is on the whole is very good because people are having to think more carefully about their food. But they really do have to think carefully about their food.
So the word natural, what does that mean in this context? It could mean anything, couldn't it?
The USDA years ago has begun to define some things in certain parts of meat, in poultry and in beef. It's defined sort of, I can't remember exactly what the definition, but a little bit. Natural, as if you read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, you learn that natural actually is defined as flavors. You read in many products have natural flavor on it. You figure, right. Well, that must be some sort of essence of strawberry. In fact, what that is a chemical synthesis of strawberry. It is, and that's the way they've defined it.
And what did you say your T-shirt says about natural?
Oh, my son worked on a farm up in the Okanagan Valley of British Columbia for the last year, the last growing season. He'd like to be a farmer. That's another interesting question, where we get the new farmers. But he got to be friends with people who were developing a microbrewery there. And one of their T-shirts, it's a Cranag microbrewery, and one of their T-shirts says on the back of it, it says, organic because natural means nothing, which is... for the most part, true.
More on the topic of farmers markets and sustainable food systems when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Wisconsin Public Radio's website is a great place to give us your thoughts. Visit WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback to send your comments about this program and anything else you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio. Leave your comments anytime at WPR.org.
For virtually everyone in the North and for many in the South, to eat is to participate in a truly global food system. In any supermarket here in Madison, Wisconsin, we can find tomatoes from Mexico, grapes from Chile, lettuce from California, apples from New Zealand. And in what we take to be an indicator of a developing slippage between the terms sustainable and organic, we can even buy organic blackberries from Guatemala, which may be organically produced, but in all likelihood are not sustainably produced if the term sustainable is understood to encompass more than on-farm production practices and any reasonable element of social justice. We cannot, however, count on finding Wisconsin-grown tomatoes, grapes, lettuce, strawberries, or apples in any supermarket in Madison, even when those crops are in season locally. That food in the United States travels an average of 1,300 miles and changes hands half a dozen times before it is consumed is deeply problematic. That's a passage from an article called Coming Into the Food Shed by one of our guests, Jack Kloppenberg. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Barry Orton and Jack Kloppenberg. We're talking about farmers markets and sustainable food systems. So let's talk about that term, Jack, that you came up with, food shed. What does it mean?
Well, I didn't come up with it, actually. The ideas go round and come round, and I actually found food shed. And as soon as I saw it in an article by a guy named Arthur Goetz, actually writing about farmers markets and CSAs, it really resonated with me because I'm familiar with the term watershed, and it seemed that food shed worked in a variety of ways because a watershed, of course, is a defined area within which water flows to a particular point. A food shed, I thought, it's kind of hard to get a hold of the global food system in which food is traveling all over the place in many different ways and in many different formats and in many different hands, and how to conceptualize oneself as a part of that. The food shed, the region from which you may be eating, and the sort of total land area and also the sort of social conditions and villages and places that contribute to what I put into my mouth. And I looked into it a little more and found that, in fact, in 1935, A guy had written a book called How Great Cities Are Fed, which talked about the food shed of New York City. And that he may well have derived from milk sheds, which is a term back in the 30s that would have been familiar to dairy scientists here, which was the place from which a particular dairy or cheese factory collected its milk. And then coming into the food shed, I took from that Buddhist poet, Gary Snyder. He wrote an article. He's also an activist. Gary Snyder, a very well-known poet and also a bioregional activist, wrote an article called Coming Into the Watershed. And I took the title from him, Coming Into the Food Shed, to see, can we think of, just as he was talking about a watershed as an organizing, an area to organize, I was thinking of how might we envision where each of us is, or where, you know, what's my own food shed or what Madison's food shed might be, and how we begin to conceptualize where we are, not just as a place to eat, but as a place to take responsibility for what we eat and to come home to a place. And that, I think, is for me, beyond the energy and the locality and all kinds of things, all the stuff that might be associated with eating more locally, I want to be clear that this is not a kind of xenophobic sort of, I don't want to eat anything from Iowa, and I don't want to draw lines around things. Because I like coffee, and I would like to get coffee that I drink every morning, but I just, this morning, bought at my co-op, at the Regent Market Co-op. I bought Just Coffee, is an organization here in Madison that buys fair trade coffee and roasts it. And they had a new variety of coffee for me called Michisa, which is a cooperative in Mexico that actually one of my graduate students studied for his PhD. I can be connected to distant places if I'm connected in a sustainable way, in a socially just sort of way. Now, that's easy to say, harder to do, but as long as it's in my head when I make those decisions, maybe I make better decisions. But how do I know what's going on in Guatemala, or how do I know what's going on in New Zealand or elsewhere? And 90% of the time, I'm here in Madison. I'm not other places. And what I think is important about eating, looking for your food to source it locally, not all of it, but as much as it as might teach you, is to develop a kind of perceptual ecology. Who am I here? What is available to me here? Who are the people that are here with me? And if I learn about this place here, I may be able to translate those understandings maybe a little better than I might have otherwise to the abstractions, which is the way I understand the rest of the world. So I think eating locally is not an end in and of itself. It's a process through which one can learn.
What does that fair trade mean?
Fair trade is another one of these terms that means a lot of things, like organic and like sustainable. But it has been relatively stabilized by a variety of organizations that do the same thing that the USDA does, which is to set up some rules and have third-party certification of how things are produced. Conventional trade is that you produce coffee or soybeans. Coffee, let's take coffee as an example that many people would be familiar with fair trade coffee, or at least might have heard of it. That it should be that Maxwell House wants you to have coffee at the lowest possible price, and they will purchase from whoever can produce coffee at the lowest possible cost to them, whether it's in Vietnam or Brazil or Mexico, and they don't care how it was produced. They just want it cheap, and they don't care whether it's sun coffee with lots of pesticides on it or, you know, semi-slave labor in Guatemala. It doesn't make any difference to them. Fair trade tries to set up a food chain, a trading chain that is fair and just and benefits people all the way along the line. So that, and one of the things it tries to do is shorten the distance between a producer and a consumer by cutting out various middlemen in various ways. The middlemen are middle people, our middle organizations are important. But for example, with the Michisa Cooperative, you have organic farmers who are contracted with a fair trade organization, whether it's Just Coffee here in Madison, those who are purchasing, but they are contracted to purchase from farmers, often small. The farmers have to be organized in a cooperative. They agree to pay a price that is at a living wage or a sustainable wage rather than the world market price, so you're paying more for it. They agree to purchase and provide information in transparent sorts of ways, and they try to reduce. So farmers get a higher price. They get an assured forward contract, and they need to organize themselves in a democratically run cooperative. So that's the kind of coffee that one can purchase. It does cost more, just as organic food costs more, as fair trade cheese in this country costs more. How do you know that it is fair trade? How do you know that the purchasing organizations are actually paying farmers more, that they have a just contract. There are certification organizations, just like FLO is perhaps the most of the Fair Trade Labor Organization, that examines and goes to these places. As we were talking about with organics, and I'm not sure that was made clear, that here the USDA has third-party contractors who go to farms to make sure that farmers are actually following the organic rules, go to the wholesalers and make sure that they're following the organic rules. In the same way internationally for fair trade bananas, for fair trade coffee, that the rules are being followed all the way along the line. So you're paying a little more, though often not that much more. But you're paying for a cup that you can have some confidence in that it really is sustainable in a social sense as well as environmentally.
What's the difference between a farmer's market and a CSA? Because you see people carrying things produced by a CSA. What does it stand for and what does it mean?
A CSA is community-supported agriculture. And what happens in those cases are that people buy what's called a share. And that means they are paying a prepaid amount usually for a season or part of a season. And they get a share of what that farmer produces every week, usually in a large box or a bag, but usually in a box. And they pick it up sometimes at the farmer's market, sometimes at the farm, or sometimes at a neighborhood drop-off point. And what that does is allow the farmer the money in advance. The consumers are sharing some of the risk of what's going to happen in the season. The standard farmer's model is the farmer takes all the risk. And the middlemen and the supermarkets and the consumers take very little of the risk. And as Jack would say, that's sometimes not sustainable. In a CSA, if, for example, the weather turns very bad and your farmer normally packs 2 pints of strawberries in every box during the season and the strawberry crop wasn't as good and you might get one, you don't get a refund. You might get additional corn in corn season if this corn season is good in that box. And it's always kind of a let's see what's in the box this week process. But that CSA purchase made in advance allows small farmers who do this kind of work to have some financial security going in and through the season that they're going to survive and make a profit enough so they can keep on farming. And it connects the farmer to the consumer in a very direct way. Is that a reasonable way to describe CSAs?
That really is. They're growing. And ironically, the problem that most CSAs have is not so much making sure that the boxes are full, but that people have too much. The box has an abundance of sometimes unfamiliar vegetables. What do you do with a daikon radish?
Often
what
true,
do you do
yes.
with a kohlrabi?
I've noticed
I don't
that.
Like kohlrabi. The interesting thing there is that we haven't, you know, usually seen the sort of manifestation and the farmers needing to actually depend upon the support of their customers. But last growing season, that's exactly what happened. And you will remember the flooding that occurred. And a variety of farms on the western part of the state over in the Driftless area were completely washed out. You know, they had squash floating down the Kickapoo River, quite literally, and sheets of water taking out whole fields.
And barns floating down that river, too.
Barns floating down the river. And it was interesting to see. It was a kind of an experimental test of would consumers actually act on their support for the CSAs. And the outpouring of financial resources was very substantial indeed. Nowhere near what farmers needed because CSA farmers don't enjoy the kind of subsidies and the crop insurance that the commodity crops like soybeans and corn enjoy. So they didn't have any insurance for the most part, any subsidized federal insurance. So the substantial outpouring of support from their customers who were not going to receive anywhere near what they usually do was very useful and a really heartening proof of the theory that support would be forthcoming. It was validated.
So why is it so hard to find a decent tomato? They must grow them all over Wisconsin, right?
Well,
but they bring them in
problem,
from all over the place.
Here's the problem. The problem is that the decent tomato season, you're talking about a tomato that tastes like it should.
Like a tomato, yeah.
Is a season that it's not that short, but it starts late here in Wisconsin. Of course, and it gets later as you go further north. And so if you're growing a tomato for market outdoors – you're not putting them in a hoop house or a greenhouse. You're not doing it hydroponically. You're not adding a whole lot of fossil fuel to move that tomato up earlier. Your tomatoes won't be ready for market till sometime in late July or early August. And when they do get ready for market, so do everyone else's. And so there's not a steady market for it. There is a market for it. But the same time you can buy that, finally buy that good local tomato, your neighbor's tomatoes all have come in and they're giving them away.
Right.
And so it's a timing problem and a marketing problem. The tomatoes are out there and they're great tasting, but they're not quite ready yet without some artificial help. And that season will go until the first frost, really. But once it comes in, everybody's got them. And so the demand might be there, but the supply is too abundant.
It's way too lopsided, you're saying.
That's right.
In the timing of it.
That's right. And that's why they invented the hard as a rock, looks red, but doesn't taste like anything tomato, which is shipped from wherever throughout the year. And people buy them because there is really aren't many alternatives for that product at that moment. But it's really a timing issue more than anything else.
All right, then. How about apples? And this brings up the question of how much can you do to something like an apple to market it? Can you wax it? Can you dye it legitimately?
For organic? If you come to the farmer's market this – and we're going to the farmer's market this Saturday because Lodi apples are in. Lodi because I'm not – it might have been bred in Lodi, New York, actually.
I was going to say, that would be really early.
They're early. They're green. They're about this big. If you like tart apples, they're absolutely delicious. But what do you do with the apples and how do you counter the seasonality is we make applesauce out of these and put some plums in and you get this lovely red applesauce and it is a pleasure. You will never get better applesauce than what you make yourself. So they're coming in. But then and this raises the interesting seasonality question and the diversity issue. You know, people don't realize that tomatoes can be green. Tomatoes can be green with yellow stripes. They can be red with yellow stripes. They can be almost black, black crims. They can be Cherokee purple, all sorts of different colors and sizes, reds, yellows, oranges. And the same way with apples.
Yes.
They come in at different times. They have different flavors. They have different functions.
Different looks.
And different looks. And one of the things that when you begin to eat more regionally and more locally and more diversely is you discover the pleasures that come with not being a foodie like having to go to the top restaurant in New York City or for that matter in Madison and get precious about food, which is fine. But the food movement sort of takes a bad rap in becoming too precious. And there's one very visible end of that, but it really is much more. And eating well can be eating very simply indeed. One of my favorites is just a Greek salad with my own tomatoes and some feta cheese that can come from Bulgaria as well as from the feta goat cheese that Dream Farm is making out here these days that is really good. And my own onions and, that and some Madison sourdough bread is a wonderful, wonderful meal. It doesn't have to be deeply complex.
Do we ever have to go outside of Wisconsin for cheese as long as you've mentioned cheese?
You certainly never would. Everything can be produced here and just about all the cheeses are analogs of famous cheeses are produced here and certainly cheese is something you can store.
What about anti-food products like cheese spread, Spam? Can you talk about sort of the anti-food stuff?
Well, they're food. They're food, I guess. They're industrial food to the limit, I suppose, the food that can make it. But, of course, they have their uses as well. Spam kept a lot of people alive in a lot of bad situations over the years around the world. And certainly there's places for that industrial food. But when you have the alternative in front of you, when you have local meats, even if it might cost a bit more or you don't eat it that often, the difference in taste, the health differences, and again, I'll go back to the difference in the impact on the local economy, I think is stuff that you really can't not take into account. That takes us to the word of the year, which is locavore, which is omnivore. You eat everything. Locavore, you eat local.
It is localvore or locovore?
Locavore, I think, is the
some people call it loco or local, but it's the concept is the same. And, of course, you don't – like everything, you don't go into two extremes. I knew a couple years ago who spent a year eating nothing but local food as much as they possibly could. And they made some key exceptions like coffee or salt. But they could do it, and they did it fairly well. But there were times during the year that they would tell you they really would have rather not done it. But, it depends on where you live, how you live. But – in general, if you want some kinds of rules of thumb, local is better than not local. Well, I think that's a pretty easy rule of thumb for many, many products.
We don't, many of us, store food the way we used to. I mean, you know, Jack, you mentioned this, you opened this issue of seasonality. And if you think of, well, you know, my grandmother in Iowa used to have a fruit cellar, you know, she called it the cave, and year long she would keep
right.
certain things down there. But we don't, many of us do that anymore.
No, we don't, but that's a skill and a skill set and a whole set of practices that, again, like other things we talked about, is coming back in a very big way. People who come to the farmer's market are asking those kind of questions all the time. What can I do with all this stuff? And the answer is often put it by in one way or another. You can can it. You can pickle it. You can save it in any number of ways that I have no expertise in. But people are doing that. And the problem, of course, in our modern era, it takes some time and some work and some knowledge. The knowledge is easy. There are books out there. There's the internet. There's a lot of places you can figure out how to make that applesauce. It doesn't happen instantly. None of these things we're talking about are instant gratification things. They mean time, work, energy in some cases.
The slow food movement.
Right.
And we'll get into that right after this. You're listening to University of the Air.
When you have a question about Wisconsin Public Radio, call our audience services team. They'll find the answer for you. For audience services at Wisconsin Public Radio, call 800-747-7444 with your programming questions and comments.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Jack Kloppenberg and Barry Orton, and we're looking at farmers markets and sustainable food systems. And as long as Emily mentioned slow food, I'll ask, what is that? Is it tied into what we were just talking about, putting things by for a long period of time by preparing them yourself?
That's one way. I think it's the, in general, it's the kind of the polar opposite of fast food. And fast food sort of indicates something you buy quickly, don't cook or get and doesn't need much preparation, something that you eat very quickly and maybe forget about very quickly. Maybe it goes through your system very quickly. I don't know. But the slow food movement, I think, entails all the opposites of that that we've been talking about. It usually means local. It usually means some preparation. It usually means trying to do something in a simple, normal, traditional way versus an industrial way. I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, that's the sort of functional end of it. It actually is a political and a social movement as well. It is some 10 years old, maybe a little bit older now. It actually originated in Italy when a McDonald's, I can't remember whether it was Rome or Florence or maybe Venice, but in one of those cities there was a proposal to put a McDonald's in. And a variety of Italians found that this extension of the global industrial food system, which is actually occurring all over the place in France and everywhere else.
China.
This slow erosion in China, slow erosion of just as we may not be processing and canning as we used to, the same little bit ahead of Europe, but the same processes are going on there. And a guy named Carlo Petrini began a slow food movement, which has a snail as its symbol. And develop convivia would be the plural, chapters of slow food, first in Italy, then in Europe, and now all over the world in a whole variety of ways. There's a chapter here in Madison, and there's a chapter on the University of Wisconsin campus. And slow food is dedicated to honoring slowing down. And in fact, Odessa Piper of L'Etoile used to say, you can eat fast food slow. And she talked about how she actually enjoyed the McDonald's fish, which which she said, I eat it slowly. And it's not only to emphasize the mindfulness and pleasure that can come from food, but the need to retain and recover and preserve food traditions and the varieties of tomatoes and apples and chickens that are available for humans to eat. So slowing down, it's a kind of cultural manifestation. You know, the food movement as a whole, the agri-food, alternative agri-food systems movement has got all these sort of tendrils to it. That one is sort of the foodies and those who are interested most in taste and pleasure. But there's also the environmental angle. There's the environmentalists interested in reducing pesticides and so on and reducing erosion. There are farmers who want to farm differently. There are the hunger advocates who would like to see access to more people for quality food. But it is – food, of course, is fundamental to all of us. And there's the power of this thing, is that something that all of us do every day and put into our mouths and can make small choices about. Automobiles, you have to – am I gonna get rid of the car I have right now and walk or bike? That's a pretty good-sized chunk of behavioral change to undertake. But with food systems, with food, what we put in our mouths, we can make small opportunities every day to enact some alternatives.
Well, and that's
– Slowly.
Well, right.
Slowly. There you go, too, is that there's – no immediate solution, which is, I think, also something that anybody talking about sustainability has got to understand, that this is a long-term process, that we are not going to cross the Jordan into sustainability land tomorrow, that we're probably much more like Moses and may each of us never actually see it, but that we've got to be committed to getting there and to taking the small steps that will move us in the right direction.
Well, let me give you a concrete example. Let's take a single mother in inner city Milwaukee on food stamps who's working two jobs, doesn't have time to go to a farm or money, resources to go buy things for a really healthy Greek salad and take the time to make it. And is probably going to have diabetes from eating very cheap, fatty food.
And worse, doesn't even have the normal supermarket opportunities that the suburbs have, because those supermarkets are in the inner city of Milwaukee or anywhere aren't there anymore either. Mm-hmm. So it's a very tough situation you're describing.
Right. So what do we do to change the basic inequity of that?
Well, the first thing that I think that I always need to say about this is that the solution does not lie in food. It does not lie in the food system. It lies outside the food system in our political system, and it's called a living wage. It's called poverty. If you don't have money and if you don't have access to transportation, yes, you're going to have a hard time participating, not just in quality food, but quality education, quality health care, and a whole range of things. Those inequities can only be solved ultimately by the political system in Washington. It's our job to conscientize ourselves if we're interested in food or if we're interested in health care, to take those additional steps, not just to eat but also to vote not only with your fork but in the voting booth too. That's part of the food system, and there's the solution there. In the meantime, there are things that can and should be done to provide. In the first place, people – in fact, a woman named Lydia Zepeda, a professor here in consumer science, has done some very interesting work showing that Latino and black consumers are more interested, in fact, and have more faith in organics, more interested in sustainable foods than are Caucasian consumers. Really interesting. They're sometimes thought not to be interested in it. The problem is they don't have the money to act on those preferences. And also, as Barry says, is they frequently are living in food deserts, as he was saying, where it's 3 miles to a large supermarket that will likely not have very good quality fresh vegetables anyway. And it's hard to get there on the bus and to do your shopping. So your only option is the 7-Eleven convenience store, which has only the things that, in fact, all of us, regardless of our class or our income position, like to eat, which is sugar, salt, and animal fats. And, you know, the poor don't actually eat that much differently than those of us with more money when you actually take those nutrients into account. And they're actually eating very rationally because the foods that are available to them, the calorie-dense foods, are the least expensive. And if you're trying to buy carrots or lettuce per calorie, it's much more expensive to buy fresh, even though those are the nutrient-dense foods.
There is one thing in Milwaukee we should mention that's kind of a glimmer of hope, and that's a project called Growing Power by a guy named Will Allen that started in Milwaukee and is now branching out in a number of places and got a tremendous story a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times Magazine.
Yes.
And he is building essentially an urban food system. He's got farms going in urban areas. He's got trainees and people working the farms who are high school dropouts who are looking for direction. And then he's trying to sell some of that food back to the people in Milwaukee. Of course, some of it is also being sold directly to restaurants in Chicago. And he recently won one of those MacArthur Foundation Genius Grants for doing that. And he's got a number of supporters here in Madison and around the state. And it's an amazingly important project, but it is a drop in the very large bucket.
I would say the University of Wisconsin College of Agriculture and Life Sciences is actually thinking about an urban experiment station now in Milwaukee and is working with Will Allen and working with the Walnut Way Project in Milwaukee to try and allocate some resources in those directions. I would also say that community-supported agriculture farms are taking action on this in their Partner Shares program, in which people can donate, other more affluent members of the CSA can donate money to provide subsidized shares for lower-income people. There are also worker shares, which are not easy to do, and it's open to students as well as people who might not have the money up front to buy a CSA share, who can actually work at the farm to offset some of the costs there. In Oakland and in New York City, in nearly all urban centers, there are actually analogs to Will Allen's Growing Power organization in which people of color and lower-income people are taking action on their own. And I think that what it does behoove those of us who are in various organizations that are less diverse is to become aware of those things and to support them. I would also say that there's a Southside Farmers Market here.
That's right.
Run by maybe the only black farmer in Dane County, certainly in Madison, a guy named Robert Pierce. And it might be for people who are normally buying at the Westside Farmers Market or going to the Dane County Farmers Market on a Thursday or a
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Or I believe
Thursday afternoon.
Thursday afternoon, Tuesday afternoon and evening. And I think he's now expanded to the Southwest Side as well. There's a new farmers market there that he's helping to run. The city is helping to support, because that's the other impact, I guess. Farmers markets are not only places you buy food, but they are also wonderful so-called third places, which are community-centered places where people can interact in any number of ways beyond just the purchase of food. And so it becomes kind of a center of a community itself. Mm. And so, yes, we do have the analog of Growing Power here in Milwaukee. In fact, Robert Pierce was quoted in that New York Times article. And it's a enormous jewel for Madison to have those kinds of farmers markets doing those kinds of functions.
We also needed to mention, I think, community gardens, of which there are nearly 20 in Madison right now, displaced as – there's not much empty land. There are, 13,000 empty lots in Detroit. There aren't many here on which community gardens might be placed in Detroit or Philadelphia. But here in Madison, there's demand for urban land. There nevertheless are 20 community gardens. These are gardens for people who are low-income who do not own their own land. I'm fortunate to own my own house. I have a garden on my own land. I'm also part of a community garden. And Barry was mentioning the diversity that you may see at a farmer's market, especially the South Side one. Community gardens are the same way. I have met an awful lot of people from Russian immigrants to Latino immigrants to people from Asia and from Vietnam and Laos that I would never have encountered otherwise, except that I enjoy gardening and I'm in a community garden. They're threatened, however. My own garden is threatened. We've defended it once. I've been in it for 20 years. We've defended it once. We're trying to hang on to it now, as in this financial crisis. The state looks to sell off land that is our land as a community for a short-term economic gain. The same thing is happening with Drumlin Farm down here on the South Side, that developers are getting – Drumlin Farm has been around for some 20 years as well, with some countercultural types and some diverse types, and people have been living there and don't own the land but have had access to it and made it productive land over time. The owner has now decided, well, it's time for me to take these 60 acres, of which only a few have been in community garden,
right,
but to sell it off and develop it as a campus, as a business campus, using TIF funds, using public funds. Why should, if public funds are going to be involved, why shouldn't some of that land be made available permanently for people to grow food on? Because, again, it isn't just the taste. The growing of it is a great pleasure, as those of us who garden know. The joy for the body and to taste tomatoes that you remember your own labor in and can taste your own sweat in, taste a little bit differently. A guy named Wendell Berry talks about extensive pleasure. He's an English professor and a farmer.
And a novelist.
Novelist and icon of the sort of alternative agriculture movement. Advises us to look for extensive pleasure. As he says, not the pleasure of the mere gourmet, which is the pleasure that the receptors on your tongue and your brain tell you about the taste itself and the chemical reactions and so on, which is all fine. And that's what taste mostly is. But what he means by extensive pleasure is to understand the context within which that food was produced. The history and the memory and the knowledge that can come with whatever you put into your mouth. Extensive pleasure is a nice way to say it.
Well, we've certainly tapped into something much bigger than I think any of us would have suspected, this phenomenon of the farmer's market and sustainable food systems, and not just a matter of eating, but so many other things. And thanks for enlightening us, Jack Kloppenberg and Barry Orton, on this topic.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks also for the snap peas.
Snap it in front of the microphone. There you go. There we go.
Get into that right after this. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.